This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Podcast in LGBTQ plus studies. I'm Shohini Chatterjee, PhD student in gender, sexuality, and women's studies at Western University. And I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Dr. Hannah McCann, senior lecturer in cultural studies in the School of Culture and Communication at the University of Melbourne. We'll be talking about Dr. McCann's book entitled Queering Femininity, Sexuality, Feminism, and the Politics of Presentation, published by Routledge in 2018. Welcome to the New Books Network, Hannah.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very excited to have you here today. If I can begin by asking, could you tell us a little bit about how you came to critical femininity studies or how it came to you and how did you conceive of this book in particular? Over to you.
Yeah, so this book is based on my PhD research that I completed at the Australian National University. And I mean, I guess when I started, I had kind of vague ideas, like a lot of PhD students when you're starting a PhD. And I wanted to write a kind of, you know, critical engagement with feminism and feminist theory around femininity. I'd always kind of been interested in this, area, but as I talk about in the book, a lot of that's just from my personal experience and, you know, growing up and in this kind of like feminist household, but it always kind of being a little bit at odds with my own gender presentation. And it wasn't until like a few months into the PhD that I actually discovered this term, femme, so queer femme as this kind of identity position in LGBTQ communities where, you know, people were embracing and celebrating their femininity, their feminine gender presentation, and reclaiming it as a queer kind of position and, you know, talking about the fact that if you're queer and feminine presenting that you sometimes can be seen as not queer enough or read as heterosexual. And indeed, when you're in kind of straight spaces, your queerness is totally invisible. And then when you're in queer spaces, your queerness is still invisible. So I came across this and it was like a revelation to me. I thought, oh my gosh, like this is me. I'm a queer femme. And this kind of taps into so many things I was already thinking about femininity and feminism, but brings in this other angle, the kind of queer aspect. And yeah, from there, that's really where I started focusing on queer femininity and femme subculture, The book's based on interviews that I did with people who identify as queer femme in Australia. And it wasn't really until the end of my PhD that I heard about the field of critical femininity studies. I mean, at the beginning of my PhD, I don't think it had even really been discussed in many places. So it was an emerging field in response to the dominance of masculinity studies. And, yeah, so that's how I kind of articulate myself now, is someone sitting within the field of critical femininity studies who's attempting to, you know, give time and attention and seriousness to the topic of femininity.
Wonderful. What struck me in this book is the idea of utopian femininity and how it is not merely a subject position punished and consumed by capitalism, but capable of engendering radical anti-normative possibilities beyond the politics of representation and the empowerment-disempowerment binary. Could you perhaps expand on the complex idea of utopian femininity, which is the anchor of your book, for our audience?
Yeah, so I think that when we talk about femininity a lot of the time, it does fall along this kind of empowerment-disempowerment binary. So it's all about, you know, either reclaiming our feminine side or expression as like some agentful thing that should be celebrated. And, you know, it verges into this very quickly, this kind of choice feminism, which is, you know, based on the idea that it's all about the individual making choices about how they present themselves and so on as the, you know, justification. And then on the other hand, you have the kind of critique of femininity, which is like, it's very disempowering because it shows a capitulation to norms of gender, expectations of heterosexual presentation, you know, beauty culture norms and the kind of oppression that comes along with that. So, like, there's not much room there, right, between this kind of like quite neoliberal individualist understanding of expression versus this very kind of structural top-down oppressed kind of subject idea. And what I wanted to do with the book was really look at the kind of in-between space, that is like the experience actually and the feelings associated with feminine presentation and this kind of subjectivity. And I think that once you start to kind of strip away the kind of didactic politics of the, you know, disempowerment, empowerment binary, and just kind of start to look at how people feel, it's not like those issues of agency and structure become irrelevant. Like, obviously they're still at play, you know, gender norms are real, they do circulate, you know, people are oppressed by kind of expectations and people do have agency. So it's not like any of that tension goes away, but you start to get a different picture of how people are kind of navigating their lives in that context, amongst that binary. So it's in that space, I think, that you get this kind of glimmer of a possibility of what a kind of, you know, we might call like utopian femininity might look like, in the sense that, you know, and I'm really borrowing from José Esteban Muñoz a lot in the book here around the idea that kind of queer utopia is always on the horizon. It's not something that we can kind of grasp directly. It's this like future possibility that we strive towards. And I think that, you know, similarly, the way I think about gender expression is like, yes, there is this neoliberal discourse at play and this, you know, these punishing kind of norms at play. Could we find an imagining of gender expression beyond that, a utopian way of understanding it? And for me, part of the reason for thinking that's possible, or I suppose desiring that possibility, is that I just don't think that gender expression, or expression, I suppose, more specifically, falls away if we change the structure and if we don't have capitalism anymore, you know, if we don't have the system of oppression and patriarchy that we have now. Like, I just think people's desire for creative expression of themselves, you know, it might not be articulated in the same way along a gender binary, but obviously, but, you know, that the desire for expressions will still exist, and it won't be this case of kind of like everyone's just going to be wearing gray overalls and have neutral gender, whatever that could be. It's rather the opposite of that. It becomes this experimental kind of field of possibility, I think. And I think that that's what you can get a glimmer of when you talk to people about their experiences of trying to navigate this system.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you also critique the denigration of raunch culture and how femininity is performed within that culture, and how a kind of feminism appears to be hyper-aware of the sexualization of femininity in this culture and considers it to be potentially damaging. You also write that such a position views femininity as essentially steeped in consumerism, considers it to be anti-feminist and pro-capitalism, and fails to really take into account the pleasure, desire, attachment, and celebration that accompanies the embodiment of such femininity. Why do you think desire's association with femininity has come to be denigrated? And what does this mean for the present and future of queer feminism, as well as the reception of queer femininity?
Well, I mean, I think, like, I just read so many feminist critiques of raunch culture that were kind of circulating in the kind of early mid-2000s from people like Ariel Levy, who wrote Female Chauvinist Pigs, which people might be familiar with. And it just seemed so unqueer to me. I mean, I guess, you know, in critiquing this kind of sexist culture and expectations for women to reveal themselves and the kind of objectification of bodies, like, I can get on board with that, but there was just a way that it was done that kind of eliminated the experience and the women navigating this field. So, you know, really one of the things I've written kind of after the book is a paper on, which, you know, I touch on in the book as well, is like how fake breasts really became this kind of like symbol of like anti-feminism, as if, or like lost feminism. So, you know, it was like, it was almost like the feminist writing about raunch culture was like adding to the objectification by kind of like reducing, like creating these kind of caricatures of women under raunch culture and like who would, you know, dare go out and get a boob job and whatever. Anyway, so I guess I was engaging with all this kind of material and just thinking like, well, you know, what about all these experiences of, you know, women who end up kind of like kissing each other at a party or something because of this kind of sexist patriarchal raunch culture. And, you know, it's like seen as something you enjoy as like a spectacle, right? Like, or you do it not seriously. And that's been critiqued by some as like this kind of heteroflexible culture, this performative sexuality, not real queerness. And I thought, well, that's not really how people experience it though. Like, you know, what about like how that can kind of be a gateway to exploring your feelings, your queer desires, your same-sex desires? Like, look, it is. I know. I've talked to people. I mean, this is the thing. And I wanted to draw out where's the touching? Where's the feeling? Like, where's the sensations that are tied up with that? Like, or the pleasure of being viewed? Like, where's that in this account? I mean, it's just, they're very, very kind of flattened accounts, I think, of what's actually going on. And when you set up this kind of like moral panic, really, about this huge thing called raunch culture without really understanding what's going on for a lot of people that are part of this. And of course it really dovetails with a lot of kind of like sex worker negative ideas and the long history of feminist debates about pornography. You know, these are all interrelated things. And I think I wanted to add to also that, you know, long feminist history of providing a kind of queer critique of the anti-raunch position.
Mm-hmm. You also note that the discourse around political effectiveness of feminists is not enough to capture the complexity of femme identities as articulated by your interlocutors. What effects do you think deprivileging power and politics in critical femininity studies produce in the understanding of queer femininity?
Yeah, so one thing I noticed when I started talking to people who identify as queer femme is that there's this real pressure, I suppose, or expectation within that subculture to, you know, do femininity differently, to signal a kind of queerness despite one's perhaps normative feminine expression. So, you know, getting tattoos or piercings and other kind of markers which might, you know, or shaving part of your head or whatever, like something that might signal I'm doing femininity, but I'm doing it a bit differently. And that's totally understandable. I mean, myself, absolutely. I have tattoos, you know, I've done shaved my half my head and all that kind of stuff. But what, you know, what emerges from that is this idea that, you know, there's a, and particularly what emerges from the idea, not just of those norms, those kind of queer femme norms, but like that you have to embrace it as this like radical political position. It puts a lot of pressure on that identification. I mean, it requires that you do it correctly. It requires that you like own it in this way that is like asking you to enroll yourself in a kind of politics, right? Like your identity, which really, you know, goes to the heart of like debates about identity politics. But it causes anxiety. I mean, it doesn't alleviate the anxiety of not being recognized. It kind of puts a new onus on you. And I think what it does is paradoxically undermine the ability for us to see the idea of femininity as queer, because it says, well, femininity can be queer, but only this kind that matches these queer norms, these queer femme norms. And only if it's embraced knowingly and with this kind of political will. And that, to me, seems to undermine the very point of having the articulation of queer femme, which is to say it really does not matter what you look like in terms of your queerness. So, I mean, to me, that's the heart of the point of it all, is like, well, your gender expression really should have nothing. No one should make assumptions on that basis about your sexuality. And we should try and strive for a society where we are so open to the queer possibilities that we don't assume people are straight. We never assume their gender. And that's, yeah. So we can say, like in your question, it's like, what about the evacuation of politics? And that's what I mean. I don't mean it's not political. I just mean trying to alleviate the pressure of the political.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You write that when femme is understood as a resistant unsettled identity, its queer potential is somehow rendered invisible. Would you like to expand on this?
Right. Okay. Sorry. So this is really dovetailing with what I was just talking about. So it's once you put the onus on femme to do the work of resistance that you lose the kind of point of articulating femme in the first place. So it's about, you know, exactly what I was saying before, where there's this kind of like problem for the femme who doesn't feel queer enough and who doesn't feel visible. And then once you start creating these kind of queer femme norms about how to do femme properly, then you're just back at square one, because it's like, well, if you don't do that, then you're not queer enough, you're not queer femme enough. So that's really the issue at stake here.
You write, and I quote, "Femmes wish to be read as intentionally feminine and authentically queer, but not necessarily authentically feminine. In this putting on of femininity, femmes aim to communicate intentional inauthenticity," unquote. What discursive and subversive effects do you think intentional inauthenticity generate?
Yeah, so again, this really dovetails with what I was just talking about in terms of the idea, or like how intentionality is navigated and how it can become really problematic in terms of undermining the point. Yeah, I think it's this really interesting thing where it's like queer feminist is seen to be based on like a chosen femininity, and to point out the very inauthenticity of femininity as like a masquerade, which is really how femininity has always been seen, as a put on, as something that requires, you know, you consumption and you to put things on and you know, beauty products and dress, fashion. And really this kind of, there is a very strong strand in femme discourse, you know, in terms of the people I interviewed, in terms of the kind of femme texts, discussions that I analyzed in my work, of, you know, femme needing to be intentional, femme needing to signal the intentionality of that femininity and the inauthenticity of it, which, you know, I'm not sure about. Like, do we, like, what, I don't think that that doesn't, I mean, I what I mean is that really does reinforce that political problem I was talking about before. And, you know, what about people that feel it's authentic? Like, what about those queer femmes who feel like it isn't a put on, like it's something else? Like, and that, you create these kind of schisms within the experiences of queer femme, I suppose.
I'm thinking about the variety of ways in which queer femininity is understood, embodied, and performed. How do you think queer femininity can further be theorized to privilege difference?
Yeah, so I mean, I've stopped working so much on queer femme now. I mean, it's lovely to have conversations like this where, you know, I'm thinking about that work again. But much of the great work that's being done in this space is by people like Rhea Ashley Hoskin, who is just doing incredible work about kind of like masculinity and feminists and like race and femme and, you know, other like intersectional kind of issues and feminists. And it's been amazing to see actually how critical femininity studies just generally, and not just necessarily focusing on femme, queer femme identity, has just taken off. Like, so many people want to do PhDs on these topics now, and there's more publications coming out. I mean, it's not huge. It's definitely not like masculinity studies. We don't have a critical femininity studies journal yet. We don't have the kind of funding that gets given to masculinity studies scholars. But, you know, just to see that turn, I suppose, and be part of the turn toward focusing more seriously on these questions, and also not, you know, not being necessarily critical of femininity. In fact, you know, Rhea's work proposes this idea of femphobia, which is not specific to queer femininity, but more about the kind of denigration of femininity and people's experiences of that, and how masculinity is privileged in a lot of contexts and so on. It's just, it's so fantastic to have that discussion now. And I feel like that was missing for so long, and it certainly wasn't there when I was writing my PhD. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's the work that is being done about kind of, you know, different approaches to femininity and femme now. And there's also, I mean, there's like a femme conference coming up soon. I think it's called maybe like Femme Excess or something like this. I can't go because it's like the time difference is far too harrowing for me based in Australia. It's like it starts at like 1 a.m. for me. But, you know, there's this really, really good work going on. So it's exciting. And hopefully if people are interested in this, you know, you can take a look at it.
A final question out of curiosity. What are you currently working on?
So after I finished this project on queer femme identity and the kind of queering femininity questions, I wanted to keep working in critical femininity studies, but I wanted to go somewhere outside of like the queer identity politics space, because my thesis, I suppose, about the queer potential of femininity and how we should, you know, take seriously questions of femininity in all its guises and expressions, I thought, well, I want to go somewhere less obviously queer. And so I turned to the site of the beauty salon and I started doing interviews of beauty salon workers about their gender expression and presentation. And it was really interesting because I was kind of interested in this like aesthetic labor question at first, which was, you know, how you had to present yourselves in the salon. But then they kind of wanted to talk about that, but mostly they wanted to talk about the emotional labor of the salon. So the kind of things they hear from clients and the difficult things they have to navigate in those conversations around like family violence and, you know, mental health issues, marriage breakdown, relationships, job losses, gender transition, all kinds of, you know, traumatic issues and so on. And there's no training for that. So I kind of just followed this path. It was really organic, you know, just following what came up in the research. And I ended up, now I'm working on this grant funded by the Australian Research Council, which is about the relationship between beauty salon workers defined as, you know, hairdressers, barbers, beauty workers, and like, you know, manicurists, very broad, and their clients. So it's about the relationship between the workers and the clients, all of these issues about kind of disclosure, but also what those spaces then therefore mean for people. So it's really, it's kind of got this like industry focused side where it's like, well, gosh, what do we need to do to reform the industry in terms of supporting workers, providing training, debriefing mechanisms, so on, all this stuff that's missing. And also just culturally valuing that aspect and perhaps financially, because they're very low paid, feminized industry. There's industrial side, and then there's kind of a theoretical side, which is about beauty. And it's like, similarly to my work on queer femme, where I was trying to come in from a side angle, it's like when we're thinking about beauty, we don't really think about those spaces as these spaces of emotional intimacy necessarily, or the production of good feelings. We think about those spaces really along aesthetic lines. And there's a lot of moral panic, like, oh, you know, women are just so obsessed with their appearance that even during the pandemic, they're prioritizing going to the salon and so on. And it's like, well, actually, what do those spaces mean? And I've done some work so far in this grant. I did a survey last year in 2020 at the big, you know, first part of the pandemic. And people talked about it, the salon, as being the only place they could have time to themselves, have someone listen to them, have time away from their children, but also the importance of the process of being in control of your body and having your identity curated in that space, which has profound implications for people in the queer community too. You know, a lot of people talking about losing their sense of queer identity because they couldn't kind of present in the way they wanted, because they couldn't access those services like barbers. And yeah, so, I mean, it's exploring kind of similar threads from the Queering Femininity book, but just in a different site and a different focus on beauty. And if people want to read more about this or get involved even, the website is beautysalonproject.com, and you can read all of the media that we've done so far and some of the publications that are coming out. But it's a long project, so we've got a few more years to go.
That's absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much for this conversation, Hannah. I really hope the engagement with critical femininity studies continues and more people get to read your absolutely fascinating book.
Thank you so much. It's been really great to chat and think about all these fantastic questions.
Thank you again. Take care and have a great day ahead.
You too.